Welcome to Health Cetera's podcast. America's veteran population remains a group that is underserved by healthcare systems and arguably most reliant on them. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, otherwise known as the VA, administers a national healthcare system primarily dedicated to providing care and health services to enrolled veterans. However, even with a system as specialized as the VA's in place, access to health services remains distant for veterans, with obstacles such as initial enrollment in the VA and limited in-person services due to the pandemic complicating the process. Veterans have countless social, physical, and emotional challenges to overcome upon returning from deployment. Accessing healthcare services should not be one of them. On this podcast, Health Cetera correspondent and public health nurse Barbara Glickstein hosts Dr. Ali Taib, a United States Navy veteran, an assistant professor at the School of Nursing at California State University, for a discussion on how the U.S. might better accommodate its veterans and their healthcare needs. This interview first aired on Health Cetera in the Catskills on WIOX Radio on February 9th, 2022.
This is Barbara Glickstein for Health Cetera. Many people in this country may think that because troops have left Afghanistan and troops have largely left Iraq and Syria, that their emotional, mental, and physical health challenges that veterans face just go away with time. But the timeframes we're talking about are really months, years, and for many decades and their whole life. How are we serving our veterans? I asked a nurse colleague and friend, Dr. Ali Taib, to join me today to discuss these issues. Dr. Taib is a United States Navy veteran. He served as a Fleet Marine Force Corpsman with the Naval Medical Center in San Diego, 1st Marine Divisions, and 3rd Marine Division. Dr. Taib is an assistant professor at the School of Nursing at California State University. He's also an artist and producer host of RN Mentor podcast and blog. His clinical and research interests focus on veterans' health. So welcome to Health Cetera, Dr. Taib, and thank you for joining me today to talk about really critically important issues, which I am sure that some of our listeners are veterans or members of their family were veterans. My father was a CB in the Navy, and my brother-in-law was in the Navy and still very engaged with the veteran community wherever he moves to, wherever he travels. So I feel like a proud family member myself of veterans. So thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. And please know that your father's service and the service of all the family members of those who have served is always appreciated.
Thank you. So access to healthcare comes up a lot when we talk about veterans' health. Certainly pre-pandemic access was an issue, and like so many disparities and issues that were of concern prior to our pandemic, which is going on 2 years, really increased during the COVID pandemic, continues to increase. And certainly one of the ways that people reached healthcare was through telehealth. How would you say the Department of Veteran Affairs have addressed the digital divide, particularly to support the health and well-being of veterans living in rural America?
Yeah, great question. I'm going to say just access overall for the in the VA system leaves a lot of room for improvement. We still have a long ways to go. We still, just from the number of veterans that are even in the system, we're looking at less than half of the veterans that have served are actually in the VA system, and probably even less than that, less number are actually accessing the VA system for their healthcare purposes. So just from that perspective, it's just so the reason I bring that up is primarily because when we talk about veterans' health, everybody assumes all veterans get their health in the VA system, and that's just not the case.
What is the most important, or what are the many reasons or critical reasons they don't access their healthcare through the VA?
Part of it has to do with the VA has historic, if you go back, look, for example, even if we go back to the Vietnam era, many of our veterans came back from that wartime period, very disillusioned from trusting the government, trusting federal organization, federal entities or anything like that. So they never even attempted to go back into that federal health system, which is what it is. And over the years, it has become increasing, even though more and more veterans have started to use the VA system, the VA system has not managed to keep up with the demand. So even though the usage has grown exponentially, the VA system has not managed to keep up with that, which kind of goes back to your, with the conversation of telehealth or what are we doing? The VA has started to use telehealth more and more, but just getting into the system is probably the biggest barrier for veterans right now in accessing healthcare. And even from a rural perspective, when you think about it, of internet availability of internet, smart devices, all of those are also problematic. So from even though you may be in a rural area, not be able to have access to the big VA facilities, some care is available, but not a lot of care is available.
And I know that because of the pandemic, and certainly to mitigate and keep people safe, that places, even in rural areas where the library or community center or a VA center, I know that, you know, those who are involved go to the VA centers for socializing and classes and things, they were really not available to our veterans and still may not be available. I did read briefly, not to give an advertisement for Comcast, but I understand they have a fairly generous approach to veterans who can get on broadband at a much reduced rate. We certainly know that we need to have 5G and better broadband across the country that would make these kinds of things more accessible. So we know that that's one thing, particularly mental health services. During the pandemic, there have been more executive orders across state lines that may be increasing access to those veterans who seek out emotional well-being and mental health support. Is that something you've heard or know about as well in terms of mental health services?
The problem with mental health services is right now VA does not have the capacity to care for all the veterans that need mental health services. What the pandemic did is further isolate. Veterans in general tend to isolate. And that's just sort of the nature going from a military community into a civilian community. Veterans have difficulty with, in general, again, we're generalizing here, with reintegration. And I like to think about reintegration as being a lifelong process. I've been out 20 years and I still find myself having to adjust my own life or behaviors and things like that. So it is not, I don't seem like an outsider. Because most veterans, if you think about it, have developed their identities while they were in the service, right? They're grown up, their adult identities developed while they were in the military culture. And when you transition into the civilian world or you reintegrate into the civilian world, that is problematic because your identity has already been established. Now you have to suppress that identity and develop or create a new one that is acceptable by the civilian population or coworkers or what have you. So that includes language, behaviors, things that were normal in the military are no longer acceptable and normal in the civilian world.
Can you give us an example of one that perhaps still pops up in your life that others who are in your similar boat would say, oh yeah, that happens to me all the time?
Yeah, like some of the mannerisms would be a lot of military people are very straightforward, right? We don't necessarily sugarcoat things. We say things as they are, where in the civilian sector, those things would have to be put in politically correct terms, right? Like we like to like get things out, resolve them and move forward, you know, like mission focus. A lot of veterans are mission focused. What's the goal and how do we get to it? One of my biggest things, for example, was like things like ideas of like overtime. I'm like, what's overtime, right? So in the military, overtime doesn't exist. In the civilian world, especially if you're in a leadership position or anything like that, you need to get stuff done, which is something that I've had to unteach myself, is like overtime is a good thing. Even though I don't get overtime, but getting paid for the work that you're doing, right? So that's kind of what it translates to in the civilian world. Or the language, sometimes in the military, or the language of people in the military can be very colorful. You know, can't say any of them on the air, but they can be, but it's normal behavior, normal language. The sense of humor can be a bit on the dark side. Again, not acceptable back in this, in the, you know, here in the civilian world. So a lot of the things that we normally, you know, very normal in the military, not normal in the civilian world. So those things, a lot of those things, and then the camaraderie that exists in the military. Again, 20 years out, I have never seen it outside of the military, but it's something I can find three or four veterans. Like, let's say I'm at an event, three or four veterans at that event. And I can start speaking to them, on all of us will click as if we've been friends for years, right? So that kind of camaraderie you don't find anywhere else. So it's a special connection in the veteran community. So like I said, the pandemic really did significantly impact some of those connections that a lot of our veteran communities, especially those who are part of veteran service organizations, were really impacted during the pandemic.
Dr. Tayed, you mentioned this idea of transition from military life to civilian life. How prepared are our veterans for this transition? And is it an area that you believe could have some focus that would address that emotional, mental, physical, life-changing transition that may mitigate, again, some of the ongoing issues that do require and must be addressed, but it's skipped over in that transition period?
Yeah. Again, another great question. And I'm going to like take you back a little bit to, for example, what we do to indoctrinate people into the military culture, right? So as a civilian going into the military, they have me swear in, I go to boot camp. In boot camp, they pretty much strip you of all identity, right? With the hair and the clothes and anything like that, right? Everything is changed into that military environment. I live in that military environment for 24/7 for months. And then once I'm done with boot camp, they allow me to move into a military unit where everything that the boot camp has taught me is reinforced on a daily basis. So reintegration happens into the military and I'm indoctrinated into that way of life. Coming out in the civilian world, you're lucky if you have 3 days to maybe a couple of weeks transition time to leave that life behind and turn into like Mr. Civilian, we'll call it that. So not a whole lot of time. So this is why you have issues with usually, especially for the enlisted members, not a lot of savings because the military does not pay, especially it's enlisted people very well. People are not really thinking about long-term. They're just thinking about getting out of the military. Many people don't necessarily have family members to go back to. So housing becomes an issue. That support system that was the military no longer exists, so it becomes an issue. So this is a huge concern when service members do get out, plus the way the VA system is set up, which is really the system that is built to help service member in that transition process. That was the purpose of the VA. From the beginning, to help the transition of service members back into the community. It's not an automatic thing. It doesn't happen automatically. The service member has to go and seek out those benefits from the VA, and it's not an easy system. It's not at all an easy system for them to navigate through. So a lot of work that we can do on that end. The military and the veteran healthcare system don't necessarily talk to each other. So that has a long lag between the time the service member tries to get care to the time their service records comes into the VA system. Housing, again, one of those benefited items that takes a long time. Education, all of the things that are helping with the transition isn't automatic. They have to be sought out by the veteran, and they don't necessarily know how to navigate the system. And to navigate the system is difficult to begin with. A lot of times we tell our service members to go and seek out a veteran service organization like the VFW or the American Legion, one of those who have representatives who volunteer their time. Some of them are paid individuals. That's all they do is help veterans transition. But even those organizations run into a lot of roadblocks, and it's not an automatic thing. So getting benefits right after the military is always an issue for our veterans.
And it goes back to a comment you made earlier in our interview about how many are not served by the VA. That I can imagine the transition into civilian life on top of everything else that you pointed out beautifully, to start navigating through a difficult process to access those, what has become known as a benefit, is often just too difficult to obtain. So there's one area that we know that you've made very clear to us about an area for improvement. Let's go back to the access to health question. I know that the VA has created partnerships across the country, and I read that there are now about 1,100 community-based outpatient clinics across the country that also are in rural areas. What's been the response by veterans to using these community-based clinics, and are they successful partnerships?
I want to say yes, they are successful partnerships. We do have, they are costly though in the VA system to use outside VA resources. They are costly to the VA. It comes with a hefty price. But we appreciate those partnerships because sometimes those clinics are the only thing available that isn't hours away from the veteran. So those are good things. The piece that's really missing in that whole process is not all of those clinics have a veteran, the veteran cultural sensitivity or understanding, right? So I'm treating your cardiac issue, I'm treating your diabetes, I'm treating whatever else is going on, but I am missing that cultural competency, right? Or sensitivity that I need to have. And the clinics don't always have the understanding of all the exposures the veterans has had during their service, right? So depending on where you served and what kind of job you had, all of those have specific job hazards, right? So whether it's hazardous exposures or because of the area, things like burn pits, whether it was traumatic brain injuries, war, like things like PTSD, mental health issues, there's always something, some kind of an exposure that the civilian community's providers are not aware of, and we're just not asking the right questions, right? So from a billing perspective, yes, those clinics do partner with the VA. They see the veteran and then they bill the VA, but how holistic that care is, like it would be in the VA system, it may be very different, and it's just taking care of the initial illness, where we need to have a whole more holistic approach in those clinics.
That's so interesting, and something that I have heard from veterans, particularly women veterans as well, even for their GYN or healthy internal primary care access issues. Sometimes it is around sexual abuse issues in the military, and they won't go into the same areas of where men in the military might be. And I understand, I think in Seattle, the Seattle VA was one of the first VA systems that created a separate entrance within their facility for women veterans, those who identify as women, to access their health care because of the trauma from sexual harassment and sexual abuse in the military. And some of that came out of really paying attention to what the women veterans needed. And we all know that the design as well as access points need to pay attention to those points, as you've mentioned, and have that cultural sensitivity. So those clinics, hopefully, as we continue these partnerships, will get that training or have veterans on staff who have gone through these experiences, providing the care and advising on the care. Is it similar to the Mission Act that also attempted to close the gaps to access to care, where veterans can access a primary care provider more quickly than they can to a community care center, where some of that pushback had similar problems for veterans?
These different access points or benefits that they come up with, there are a lot of them tend to be variations of of things that we've had in place. I mean, the names change. Unfortunately, what we're still seeing is some of those foundational components of them are still missing. And I think I need to also mention, not every veteran is eligible for VA care. And some of our veterans, depending on their characterization of discharge, is not even considered a veteran by the VA system. So those are what we call like bad paper discharges or less than honorable discharges, which we've been fighting forever to address, because regardless of the characterization of discharge, and there's a lot of work that's right now is being through legislation is being addressed, is where is the judicial system within the military going wrong, right? So we have veterans with things like PTSD, military sexual trauma, things like that, as you mentioned, are actually becoming the victims of the Uniform Code of Military Justice and being kicked out with less than honorable discharges. So that's a huge issue. The issue recently went to the Supreme Court, where actually somebody I know had ended up suing the Navy. And the Supreme Court says, yes, the lawsuit can move forward. And as a result, the Navy is re-looking at its practices of how it's been discharging veterans with things like PTSD and traumatic brain injuries or other mental health issues. And right now, legislation is currently getting pushed through Congress around things like how the victims of, for example, military sexual trauma, where the commanding officers have up until now been able to make the decision on, and nothing against the commanding officers of various companies and battalions and things like that, but they don't have the legal know-how to address things that are related to what is going on. So that is being taken away. That power is being taken away from the commanding officers and being placed at a third party who is not connected to the military. So hopefully we'll get some better results as a result of this. So I think the biggest thing I can address is that whole idea of who is eligible, and out of those who are eligible, how many of them are actually getting care, where we should, these are earned benefits. So those are one of the things that a lot of the advocates are working on, is that component of making sure that all of the veterans, because these are earned benefits, these are not extra on top of, these are earned benefits for service that we are keeping from the veteran community.
I'm a proud New Yorker. My senator, Gillibrand, is a yes. real champion of making sure that these courts be established so that these kinds of cases can be better reviewed, analyzed, and changed where needed. And she's been fighting for this for a number of years. So as a New York resident, I'm proud and support her in these efforts. And thank you for mentioning that. I wanted to move on to the question of issues facing caregivers and some military families, veterans' families going forward around health and health access. And how well prepared are our families for the long haul of care for the veterans who really do leave the military into civilian life with lifelong challenges?
We have not done a good job. We have not done a good job at all in making sure that we are inclusive of the families of our veteran community or our military community. And that's the reality of it. A lot of time they have to fight twice as hard, especially if they are representing a family member. So that has been, I think that is another arena we need to do a lot of work in. And, you know, I was actually talking to a colleague just maybe about a week ago, but I think we, from a civilian community perspective, we need to really relook, and especially from a nursing perspective, 4 million nurses across the U.S., we need to do a better job as to understanding the needs of our veterans and our veteran families, because most of the veterans and veteran families are not getting their care in the VA system. They're getting their care in the civilian community where all of us are, right? They're not getting their care in the military. They're not getting their care in the VA. So the rest of us need to be the individuals that are closing the gap for that and making mm-hmm. sure that they are, the needs are being met. But from a benefits perspective, I mean, again, it goes back into this, the bureaucracy of the VA system and how difficult it is to get into the system to begin with. Add on top of that, that you're not actually the veteran, but you are family members of the veteran. Family members usually don't know what kind of paperwork they need. They don't have access to service records. They don't have access to the discharge, what we call a DD-214, right? The discharge form. So all of the stuff that they need access to, plus they need, if they are the representing, they need power of attorney and all kinds of stuff. So usually that's where veteran service organizations become very helpful. And sometimes, you know, not sometimes, a lot, unfortunately, a lot of times we recommend to families or even the veterans that they need to get a lawyer to try to get through the system and get their earned benefits and what is actually entitled to them.
Well, that's the second major area that you've mentioned during our talk today. So I just, we have a few minutes left and I wanted to pose a question to you, a hypothetical question, but you would be so perfect to be on this panel, to be invited to the VA for this meeting. You were called in to join this meeting at the Veteran Administrative Headquarters in Washington, D.C., and our Veteran Affairs Secretary, Dennis McDonough, was there as well as other top leadership. And you were asked to come to address the shortcomings at the VA. You've mentioned several top issues. I'm wondering what else is on the top of your list and what would you bring on your agenda to this meeting?
I think the first thing I would bring to the agenda would be something that the VA has actually absolute control over. What the Congress has said to the VA is benefits need to be provided to veterans, all the benefits, except for those who are dishonorably discharged. There's five characterizations of discharge. Only one of them is dishonorable discharge, right? And that's by court martial and the whole nine yards with that. So that leaves four other characterizations of discharge, which technically under Congress's mandate would be eligible for benefits. The VA has extended, the VA, not Congress, the VA has extended the definition for that to be dishonorable discharge, bad conduct discharge, and other than honorable discharge. So they have added two additional characterizations of discharge under the bad, what we call technically bad papers, right? Or under dishonorable conditions. That's what the VA's definition has broadened itself to. And in addition to that, if you don't have an honorable discharge, things like education benefits. So if you have an administrative discharge, education benefits would also be one of the things that goes away, which we know it has lifelong impact as far as income and ability access to education. So the VA is very much able to remove some of its own self-imposed barriers in providing care. So I think that's one of the first things that I would say, that because the VA has control, they don't need to go to Congress. They don't need anybody else's approval. They just need to remove the self-imposed barriers to care and the barriers that they put into place for our veterans to get the care that they need or the benefits that they need. I think that would be the one thing that I think the VA it can do and should do immediately. They did it a couple of years ago, but they only extended it to 90 days, 90 days of mental health care for people with PTSD. And that's only for the other than honorable discharge characterization. But after a 90-day review, which even the 90-day review is running into a lot of barriers, and people are getting pushed out of the system before they have a full review of their mental health status. And to add on top of that, people who are in that 90-day system and the VA determines that no, they did not meet the VA criteria are being charged for that care. So there's a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of things that are happening that should not be happening for the people that sacrifice so much in the service of this country.
Dr. Ali Taeb is a United States Navy veteran, having served as a Fleet Marine Force Corpsman with the Naval Medical Center in San Diego, 1st Marine Divisions and 3rd Marine Division. Dr. Taeb is an assistant professor at the School of Nursing at California State University. He's an artist, producer, host of RN Mentor podcast and blog. His clinical and research interests focus on veterans' health. I thank you for joining me today, and I do hope you get that invitation to Washington, D.C. to express your compassionate advocacy on behalf of your fellow veterans of the United States. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of HealthCetera in the Catskills. For more podcasts and discussions of important health issues and policies affecting health, go to HealthCetera's website and blog at www.healthmediapolicy.com. That's www.healthmediapolicy.com. This podcast was produced by Diana Mason, Barbara Glickstein, and production assistant Kai Volsey.